Now we go overseas. You are listening to a podcast from the Historical Society Lastoria, Bremen, Germany, in cooperation with volunteers in the United States. Part 1, Out of Necessity to America. Hessian refugees in the 19th and early 20th century. Up and away. The people of Hesse have left their hometowns. They go with their children, far, far away, via Bremen, Bremerhaven, some also via Hamburg, to America. We want to tell some of their stories and turn back time by a little more than two centuries, not quite to the 8 years of the American War of Independence, 1775 to 1783. This is when the Landgraf of Hesse Cassel rented thousands of his male subjects as soldiers to the British, and they sang goodbye at the parade in Cassel.
Yea to America. To you, Germany, good night. You Hessians, present your rifle. The Landgraf is coming to the watch. Goodbye, Landgraf Friedrich. You pay us liquor and beer. If we lose an arm or a leg, if men are shot, England will pay to you. You lousy rebels, you, beware of us Hessians. Yea to America. To you, Germany, good night. 4 decades later, the Brothers Grimm have collected fairy tales told to them by women in Cassel. One is about four who are sentenced to death and run away, and begins like this. There was a man with a donkey who had served him faithfully for many years, but whose strength was now running out, so that he became more and more unfit for work. The master not only wanted to cut back on the donkey's food, but he also did not want to feed him any more. The donkey, noticing that there was no good wind, ran away and made his way to Bremen. There, he thought, you can become a town musician.
Now we go overseas, overseas. Now we go over. Now we go overseas, overseas. Now we go overseas. On an old sailing vessel, 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 vessel. On an old sailing vessel, departing hurt so. On an old sailing vessel, 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 vessel. On an old sailing vessel, departing hurt so much.
The donkey, the dog, the cat, and the rooster are still mentioned as emigrants in the 1819 edition of the Children's and Household Tales, even if they did not get far. Not even as far as Bremen, to be exact. Millions of people, however, are driven beyond the borders of today's Germany to countries about which they know little. Some move overland to the east, to Poland, Lithuania, Russia, or Hungary. Others venture across the Atlantic. In 1819, anyone who wanted to leave and could read, and there were very few of them at the time, learned something about the Ordinance on the Emigration of Subjects to America, in particular the conduct of the Police Directorate of the Free City of Bremen, in the event of unsuccessful emigration projects. Whether deciphered, passed on, or read aloud, everything is eagerly devoured. In March 1835, a Bremen shipowner, Friedrich Jakob Wickelhausen, placed the following advertisement in the newspaper.
Announcement. All the ships I handled last year with passengers to the United States of America have not only arrived there happily and after a voyage of 35 to a maximum of 45 days, but the passengers have also shown their complete satisfaction with the passage, with the treatment of the ship's captain and the food received on board by a written testimony, which then also prompted me to pay the ship's captains the bonus promised to them in this case. Mr. Werner Ramsbeck Jr. had the kindness to take over the agency for me in the local area for the acceptance of passengers, and I therefore ask all those who intend to leave for the United States of America this year to turn to this gentleman as soon as possible. The same person is authorized to receive the earnest money for my account and to agree with the passengers on the conditions of the crossing.
In the port of Bremerhaven we went on our... In the port of Bremerhaven we went on our ship. With all our belongings, longings, 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 with all our belongings, we started on our... With all our belongings, longings, 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 with all our belongings, we started on our trip.
Some villages even pay for the crossing for their poor and others whom they want to get rid of. In his article on Emigrants from the Parish of Maubach, in a publication of the Ausfeld Historical Society, Wolfgang Zeim gives several examples of this. His most important source was the emigrant lists of Karl Geisel in the city archives of Ausfeld. Among those who left the country at the expense of their home community was the 28-year-old Balthazar, a beggar whom the community of Dannenrod probably sent to his older sister in the United States in 1854. In a profile from 1851, he is described as mentally weak. A few decades later, the authorities of the United States no longer allow mentally retarded people to enter the country.
The day laborer Johannes Weber, in his mid-50s from Dannenrod, is also to be deported to the New World in 1871. This does not succeed. He should have gone to New York with the Crystal, but he returns home in 1872 and claims that the German Society of the City of New York, which takes care of newcomers, has sent him back. Nobody believes him. Did he even go on board in Bremerhaven?
Most of them have to pay for their passage themselves or go into debt bondage with Americans. Shipowners, agents, carters, outfitters, innkeepers, and hoteliers all earn money from emigration. In the Fuchelsburg and neighboring regions, there are several contact points. Since 1828, the Storndorf freight driver, Heinrich Rausch, has been authorized to broker passages, as can be seen from his advertisement in a newspaper of February 1848.
Emigrants to North America can continually be transported on good, solid, three-masted first-class ships at the cheapest prices. In bringing this to the attention of the emigrants, I notice that for almost 20 years now I've been immersed in the transport of emigrants to North America to the greatest satisfaction of the emigrants and therefore licensed as a certified agent and have provided an appropriate deposit. I take care of the transport from here to Bremen with my own wagon and horses, scheduled for the 1st and 15th of each month.
And when we go on board, and when we go on. And when we go on board, go on board, and when we go on board, ours will be the tween deck, lower, lower tween deck. Ours will be the tween deck, and we will be lices. Ours will be the tween deck, lower, lower tween deck. Ours will be the tween deck, and we will be lices port.
Expectations are high, and so is uncertainty. As early as 1830, they are singing in Germany.
Oh, how many beautiful things you hear from America. That's where we want to go to. That's where you have the most beautiful life. Sometimes it is so cold here. We could freeze to death and hardly can move our fingers. And it is warm there even in winter. Nobody gets poor buying wood. The largest fish known, you can catch it with your bare hand. The carp are, on my honor, often weighing 50 kilo. The chocolate and sugar cane grow at every pond. It is hard to believe, wool grows on every tree. And when we came to the port, we were pale with grief. Everything we took with us, we had to pay for the freight. We went out to sea and many cried out, oh and woo, ach and weh. And the children looked pathetic. Oh father, oh mother, when are we home?
Over the decades, the journey becomes shorter and the crossing a little more comfortable. In March 1841, Bremen ship owners advertise in the Elsfelter newspaper.
Notification for emigrants to North America. The undersigned hereby inform the public that on the 1st and 15th days of each month, as hitherto, they will dispatch large and fast-sailing copper-plated three-masted genuine ships from Bremen, equipped with high spacious four ceilings to Baltimore and New York, and that they have appointed the postal administrator of the Grand Duke of Hesse, Mr. Philip Beppler of Schnellenhausen, as their agent.
In the spring of 1851, around 3,000 people left via Bremen in 1 month. Over the course of time, more than 4 million people from Europe are expected to take this route for different motives. Thus, democratic lawmakers flee overseas as the gains of the March Revolution of 1848 are abolished. They will be called 48ers in the United States. During the economic crisis from the Weimar Republic, unemployed people such as Heinrich Geisler from Oberglin, the 23-year-old ladies and men's tailor, will leave. He emigrated in 1922 and found work in Baltimore. His nephew, Walter Rupenthal, the son of the village midwife Marie Rupenthal, née Geisler, told in an email in 2014 how emigration came about and what happened afterwards.
The Geisler family already had relatives in Buffalo with whom they were in correspondence. This was mainly run by my mother. At the time, she also announced to the Americans that her brother was unemployed and let them know that he would now actually have time to put their clothes in order. More or less an empty phrase, the consequences of which could not be foreseen. The next letter from Buffalo was accompanied by passage booking to the United States. My mother was severely reprimanded by her parents for this. The family was turned upside down, but my Uncle Henry thought that this was quite good and took the opportunity. With the help of relatives, he rented a small apartment and from then on carried out sewing work of all kinds. Business was going well, and he soon was able to gratefully return the money for the crossing.
He took his chance. Therefore, no one will call him an economic refugee. Some Germans, however, follow the waves of emigration with mixed feelings. The song, A Proud Ship, is published in 1925, when steamships have long been traveling between the continents.
A proud ship slowly slides through the waves and carries on our German brethren. The eastern wind is blowing, the white sails are swelling. America is the destination. To stand on deck like this, to look homeward, America, to distant colonies. Do you see them moving across the great ocean? That's where they are going. Who dares to ask, why do they leave their home country? Poor Germany. Can you bear it? How your sons are so harshly banished? Look here, you who want to make people happy. Look here, you oppressors. See your best workers fleeing. Do you see them moving across the great ocean? There they move on blue ocean waves. Why do they look back wistfully? Are they so badly treated at home that they are now seeking their fortune in a foreign land? What they couldn't find here, they try to find there. They sail away from German soil and then find their grave in a foreign country.
Walter Rupenthal's uncle became an American but stayed in touch with his family in Hesse.
In 1926, he came to visit me to attend my baptism and persuade his bride, who had stayed behind in Oberglin, to come along. As far as I know, she would probably have been willing to do so. Unfortunately, the parents' veto caused this project to fail. Some people said that only good-for-nothings go to America. As a result, the engagement broke up. My Uncle Henry then met his future wife, Kita, born in 1905, from Ernstrode at the German Club. Together they ran a ladies' tailor shop, which probably went very well. In 1934, they bought a slightly larger house. Their son Herbert was born in 1930 and their daughter Betty in 1935. Both the parents and children have visited us several times in Germany. And, of course, we've been there several times.
Where there are Germans, Germans go. This also applies to immigrants from Upper Hesse. In 1927, the Jewish tailor, Nathan Lamb, from Oberglin, goes to Buffalo as well. He explains to the immigration authorities that he wants to go to Buffalo, where Heinrich Geisler lives. In the 1930 census, he is listed as Max Nathan Lamb, as Amy B. Cohen, the author of the Brotman blog, has found out. Nathan worked in the United States, first as a baker, then in construction, was in the United States Army from 1942, and returned to Buffalo after the end of the war. In those years, opponents of the Nazis and those persecuted because of their Jewish origins desperately tried to get a visa for the United States. What happened to some of them, we will learn later. Let's go back to the early 19th century first.
It is not uncommon for many people to get rid of their money before they are leaving their home country. And so, in 1832, the Bremen Senate, concerned about the good reputation of the city, instructed the innkeepers that everything that seems necessary for the benefit of those who have chosen Bremen as their place of emigration should be taken into account as much as possible. In order to protect people leaving Europe via Bremen, the first state law is passed in Germany in the same year. The Ordinance on Emigrants with Local or Foreign Ships. From now on, passenger lists are mandatory and, from 1852, must be handed over to the Verification Bureau for Emigrants, which was specially set up by the Chamber of Commerce.
If subjects want to leave Hesse-Darmstadt, they must first submit an application. The mayor forwards it to the Grand Ducal District office in Elsfeld. The newspaper then calls on potential creditors to come forward within 3 months. More and more people are arriving in Bremen. The first way leads to the verification office, and they are looking for accommodations. Are there still rooms available in the hostel, the City of Baltimore, at the Neue Markt, in the City of New York on Gross Johannesstrasse, or Zum Admiral Nelson on Langenstrasse? There are not enough rooms anymore. And so, businessman Friedrich Miesler has immigration halls built in Bremen-Findorf. He offers an all-around service, lodging, tickets, insurance, information, mostly via ships of the Neue Deutsche Lloyd.
Those who are not allowed to leave vanish. Young men who want to avoid military service are among them, such as Friedrich Trump, from Karlstadt an der Weinstraße, who will become rich as an innkeeper and brothel owner during the gold rush. Poachers also disappear without deregistering. Debtors, sometimes even entire families. Social revolutionaries who are wanted by the police. Husbands who abandon their wives. Young people and others who do not expect to get a permit. On January 1, 1848, a newspaper in Upper Hesse reports,
"The regional court of the Grand Duke of Hesse in Homburg to the mayors of the district. In recent times it has been often been the case that persons have immigrated to America without first entrusting anyone in their former homeland with the care of their affairs, which then sometimes resulted in the ordering of costly judicial curates, but always the delay of inheritance disputes and similar transactions. We therefore call on you to draw the attention of the emigrants in their own interest and the interest of their remaining relatives to the disadvantages of failing to make such a power of attorney. Signed, G. Klingelhofer."
In Hesse Castle, emigration is no longer illegal from 1831 onwards. People have already left before, as it says on the pages of the Neustadt Family Research. From 1820 to 1840, they gathered at the Burned Oak in Vossenberg Forest to trek north. They need 4 to 5 days with their horse-drawn carriages for the first stage. In Hanover-Schmunden, horses and carts are sold, and the journey continues with Weser barges to Bremen and Bremerhaven, 5 to 6 days on the river. In 1852, the main Weser Railway is built, connecting Kassel and Frankfurt on Main. For many immigrants from the region, this shortens the journey by days. You take the train to Karlshafen and board a Weser steamship, then a sailing ship in Bremerhaven. In advertisements, passengers leave reviews after the crossing, whether paid or on their own initiative. In 1841, in the newspaper from Ausfeld, the people read,
"Thanks to Captain J. H. Bossum, the undersigned passengers of Mr. Friedrich Jakob Wichelhausen in Bremen feel compelled of their own accord to praise the excellent efficiency, untiring attention, activity and caution of the captain, Mr. J. H. Bossum, of which they had the opportunity to convince themselves day and night, to boast publicly and both for this and for the courtesy shown to them, kindness and humanity to express their warmest gratitude. With the frequent complaints about the carelessness of some captains, the happiness of getting into such philanthropic, sympathetic hands undoubtedly beneficial. And we can only hope that a similar thing will happen to our subsequent compatriots. New York, June 4th, 1841. E. A. Schumann for himself and on behalf of the remaining 185 passengers."
Why break up when you can stay together? In Neustadt in Kurhesse, some families decided to emigrate together in 1832, as can be read on the website about family researched in Neustadt. The Columbus, a 3-masted ship of a Bremen shipping company, is to bring the almost 200 people from Neustadt, Momberg, and the region to America. At the end of May, the ship departs from Bremerhaven and reaches New York in mid-July after a trip of 6 weeks. Around 1880, the emigrant song was sung in Upper Hesse.
"Now is the time and hour to travel to America. The wagons are already at the door. With wife and children we march. The friends and our relatives reach out to us for the last time. Friends, don't cry so much. See you now and never." And when we arrived in Bremen and looked at the big water, we are not afraid of a waterfall. God is everywhere. And when we came to Baltimore, we raised our hands and exclaimed, Victoria, now we are in America. We traveled even further away and trusted in dear Lord. The idleness is now over. Brothers, we have to work."
At least 15,000 people from the old district of Ausfeld are said to have emigrated to the United States via Bremerhaven between 1825 and 1900, the majority of whom were day laborers and craftsmen. Families and single people have set off from Bremerhaven for New York, Philadelphia, or Baltimore. Even though the meals on German ships are supposed to be much better than in earlier times, the German Society of the City of New York still recommends in 1883 that those wishing to leave the country take provisions with them.
Smoked ham and lean meat sausage, even a piece of good cheese that lasts, is best suited for this. Zwieback and a few oranges or lemons will prove to be a very welcome addition along the way. Drinks will be purchased on board of all German steamers at cheap prices. Condensed milk for the children will be administered free of charge. The following applies to meals on the tween deck. It is served for breakfast. Coffee with milk and sugar, white bread, and rye bread with butter. Lunch at 12 o'clock. Soup with vegetables in it, meat, and potatoes. In the afternoon at 3 o'clock, coffee with milk and sugar. In the evening at 7 o'clock, tea or coffee with milk and sugar, white bread, and rye bread with butter.
If you travel in the tween deck, you should buy a straw sack and tin dishes, preferably in the harbor, the German Society also advises in 1883. Warm clothes and blankets are important, diapers and wipes for the toddlers, but otherwise only the essentials, packed in sturdy, lockable, not too large boxes, because it is often stolen on board, and the passengers with the cheap tickets have to carry their luggage themselves. Smoking is prohibited on the tween deck. Matches, gunpowder, and other flammable objects, rifles and other weapons, shall be handed over to the master for safekeeping. Gambling is prohibited, and if the officer on duty orders it, the tween deck must be tidied up or scrubbed. Twice a day, a doctor comes by to check on the passengers. It is necessary to prevent the smallpox or other diseases from spreading, by vaccination, for example, as the German Society of the City of New York writes.
The ship's doctors shall vaccinate those who have not yet been vaccinated and issue to them a health certificate, which the immigrants shall keep to show to the medical officer upon arrival at the port of destination. To isolate the immigrants affected by smallpox at sea and their luggage is to be properly disinfected.
Paying attention to cleanliness, not entrusting anything personal to ship acquaintances, patiently enduring seasickness, these are also advice for the trip. And in Castle Garden in New York, a station that passengers have to pass through from the intermediate deck, members of the German Society are on hand to assist the newcomers. If you can read, you can recognize them by the inscription on their caps. In the emigrant novel Jürgen Jakob von der Amerikafahrer by Johannes Gilhoff, the first-person narrator, a Mecklenburger, asks,
"How smart do you think someone is when they come across? As stupid as the piglet of a day laborer, one like the other. If stupidity hurt, there would be nothing to hear at New York Harbor from morning to evening but howling and lamentation. But that soon becomes unlearned. One is also pushed around here in a completely different way than over there, and if you are only a few times properly offended with one's thick head, then you soon learn to be careful and stand firmly on your feet and grasp firmly. If you can't do that, you should have saved the travel money and should not look at Germany with your back, because there, the good God is still guardian of the stupid. That doesn't really apply here. This is where most of them have their dear God in their money box. I could tell funny stories about some of those who came across, but I don't want to reprimand anyone, and most of them would only have my own image."
Some come to America in a roundabout way. In Obergleen, the descendants of linen weaver Michael Schott holds the record. The genealogist Carolyn Schott from Seattle, author of the guidebook Visiting Your Ancestral Town, has followed the traces of her family from early 18th century when Michael left his home village until the emigration of his descendants to the United States in 1905.
My family roots are in Obergleen. My great-great-great-great-great grandfather Michael Schott was born in Obergleen in the late 1600s, and so that is where my family originated in Germany. You know, when I was growing up, I always knew that my family was German. My parents spoke German. We ate German foods. Being German was a very big part of who I was growing up. And so it was something I always wanted to explore and understand more about My five times great grandfather Michael, when he left Oberglain, first he went to Osthofen, a town on the Rhine River, right by the Rhine River. And then a couple generations later, his grandson left Osthofen and went to Imperial Russia and settled in a village that's currently in Moldova. But then the family, pretty soon after that, moved to German villages in Ukraine, a couple different villages they lived in Ukraine. So they lived in Ukraine for several generations, but maintaining their German heritage. And then my grandfather left Ukraine and came to the United States.
The Gonder family also took a little longer to emigrate to the United States, two generations to be exact. Around 1890, the tailor Georg Gonder from Oberglin settled in Hamburg instead of emigrating like his older brother Ludwig. So his children had what many Germans wished for in bad times, an uncle in America. Georg's great-granddaughter Gabriella Gonder-Carey, an archivist, did some research and found out that Ludwig, who called himself Lewis in the United States, bought land in Washington State and had a large farm. Gabriella has been told that he was called the Hop King of Washington, but isn't sure if that's true.
Hops and the beer that was made of it was something German immigrants were famous for as producers and as consumers. A Bavarian, John Wagner, who settled in Philadelphia, is taken for the pioneer of lager in the United States, but around 1840, other immigrants were also already producing their own beer, and more followed. Over the decades, brewers from Bavaria, but also from Bremen, Lower Saxony, and Hamburg, succeeded on the American market. Today, in the century of craft beer, you can drink Hessian Horseman or Angry Hessian in the United States, not to mention Headless Hessian Pumpkin Ale, but that is a completely different story.
Georg Gonder from Oberglin in Upper Hesse started a family in Altona. His great-granddaughter assumes that the family has Huguenot roots, also because of the brown eyes. In the 17th century, French Protestants fled to Hesse and several thousand to Hesse Castle. The refugees brought with them a few of the fairy tales that Dorothea of Fehmarn told the brothers Grimm much later, once upon a time. But now let's fast forward to the 20th century. One of Georg Gonder's grandsons has involuntarily spent several years in France as a prisoner of war after the Second World War. In 1947, Uwe Gonder returned to Hamburg and married a Swabian. This brings us to the next generation, Gabriella, born in 1954, who migrated as a child. Her father and her mother and the 7-year-old girl went to Southern California in 1961, where Gabriella's mother had an aunt and uncle. Her father told her that he had wanted a change. There were probably also economic reasons for emigrating, as Gabriella thinks, but these were not the most important reasons. Her father's uncle had found a job for him. Uwe Gonder worked as a toolmaker at Mattel for 20 years, and Gabriella had a lot of Barbies.
For anyone who does family history research and has ancestors who emigrated, passenger lists are important sources which are now easily accessible. And so it is clear, people from Upper Hesse have also been drawn to Canada. In the 1860s, Johann Heinrich Degel, born in 1816 in Oberglin, and his wife, Catherine Ney Folkert from Erlinghausen, went to Canada. Their great-great-grandson, Lutheran pastor Matthew Hartman Degel, born in 1960, lives in Errington Township, Ontario, like many people with roots in the former Grand Duchy of Hesse-Darmstadt. His father was born in 1933 in Brodhagen, Logan Township, in the same village as his grandfather in 1900 and great-grandfather in 1873. Heinrich Lemke, Canada's guide from 1896, was definitely not needed by the third-generation Canadian. For others, it might have been helpful, especially the 10 golden rules for immigrants.
1. First think about it, then start it. 2. To act first and to think about it afterwards has already brought a lot of suffering to some. 3. Never trust anyone's word. 4. Never sign a document whose contents you do not know. 5. Never use a hack lawyer. 6. Never sign contracts in a foreign language without being well informed of their content by reliable and non-involved people. 7. Never buy land without first inspecting it closely. 8. Never buy more than you can pay. 9. Over there, always stick to the societies of your homeland, which have been established for the protection of immigrants. If you become wealthy over there, support these clubs and be grateful. It's a matter of honor for you. 10. Interest must bear your wealth, not only earthly, but also in higher and better goods.
First, think about it, then start it, or let it be. Those who do not want to emigrate hope for better times. In 1874, Georg Fett from Malbach in Upper Hesse assured his brother-in-law, Wilhelm Sommer, who lived in Indiana, that the economy was going uphill. The Malter wheat now cost 16 to 17 guilders, grain 12, barley 10, the pound of butter 30, the pound of meat 21 guilders, and with prices, wages have risen.
A proper servant now gets the year 150, also 175 guilders. We have heard that it would be a bad time in America right now because many people go around unemployed, and many even come back to Germany. Your cousin Heinrich Engel von Oberglin sends you his best regards.
Katharina Butner, née Lanz, from Malbach, writes to her parents in 1859 together with her husband Conrad from Illinois.
Dear Father, you write that you have been thinking about us for many days. Dear old Father, I wish that all your children had like me. I have it 3 times better here than in Germany. In Germany, the poor people don't have potatoes to eat yet, much less anything else, but that's not the case here. If a man creates here, he can eat whatever he wants. You don't have to give everything to the Landgraf here like in Germany. What would we have in Germany? Maybe a cow or gilded impatience. We don't need to push cows here. We now have 4 beautiful horses, 4 cows, 20 pigs, 200 to 300 chicken. This year we will slaughter 6 pigs that are bigger than the one you slaughtered from time to time. I eat more eggs and butter in a week than you in Germany in a year. If a man works hard here, he can build up an existence, but not in Germany. If you are poor, you will stay poor.
Katharina would like to have her siblings with her, so she tries to reassure her parents and is more worried about her brother Andreas, as a conscript will no longer be allowed to leave the country. The signs in Europe point to war, which will begin in 1866, in which the Hessians, as allies of the Austrians, will lose to the Prussians. This is followed by the German-French War of 1870-71 and the founding of the German Empire.
I have heard again in the newspaper that the King of Prussia, with whom we have got along here, is not to be feared by next spring. This is what the newspaper writes in Germany. You think we have war here as well as in Germany. The war here is nothing. I don't need to be afraid of that. They want to drive the Indians away. That's all the war here. I dream of my brother Andreas. He should have given a lot of thought to the soldier's life. So be so good and write to me how it goes on.
From 1861 to 1865, the American Civil War raged, in which many Germans also participated. From 1860 to 1880, the massacre of 350 peaceful men, women, and children at Wounded Knee, the white settlers and the U.S. Army also persecuted the indigenous people incessantly. Their number drops from 4 million to 250,000, and they do not receive civil rights until 1924. what people in Hesse or Bremen knew about Indians and the Wild West in the 19th century came from letters and newspapers, from novels by James Fenimore Cooper and Carl May, from the books of the Hamburg adventurer Friedrich Gerstacker, or from the Wild West show by Buffalo Bill Cody, which also stopped at the Velocipede Racecourse in Bremen and in the Palmen Garden of Frankfurt, Maine in 1890. In 1848, Georg Troy published a practical guide for emigrants, agents, businessmen who come into contact with the emigration system in Bamberg. The book contains, among other things, a collection of the most important decrees and diplomatic documents published in the southern German states, Bremen and North America, and a brief description of the United States. The author recommends Bremen as the first and most excellent embarkation place.
It is ensured here by the appropriate laws that the immigrants are not only protected from overreaching, but also that they are well fed and treated on the ships.
And Troy warns those who want to emigrate that they should not have illusions.
Whoever lacks activity, diligence, and perseverance, who shies away from privation, work, and effort, let him stay at home, because he will achieve something even less on the other side of the sea than on this side. Many who dreamed of golden mountains here have lost their own beyond and have degenerated into poverty and misery or returned here as beggars. Romancers and so-called do-getters will always be deceived in the most delicate way by the bare reality of their reveries and ideas. There is no field of activity for such people in America, nor is there much hope for scholars, lawyers, theologians, pharmacists, and servants, and they are usually compelled to earn their living by hard, unaccustomed work. Even for doctors, the prospects are by no means bright, since the number of existing ones, already very large almost everywhere, in quackery plays an extensive role. The best accommodation is found by people from the day laborers, peasants, craftsmen classes.
And which trades are particularly in demand?
Beer brewer, distiller, tailor, shoemaker, milliner, furrier, glove maker, butler, tanner, butcher, baker, confectioner, watchmaker, bricklayer, carpenter, blacksmith, coopersmith, nailsmith, plumber, wainwright, varnisher, saddler, trimmer, brick burner, milliner, book printer, bookbinder, pewter founder, cooper, and stuff printer.
Conrad Felsing from Obergleen in today's Fuchelsberg district as a master carpenter also sees good opportunities for himself in America, although he can't write. In his mid-30s, he sailed from Hamburg to New York in 1836 with the Howard, without his wife Anna Maria and without his children, and that, like the emigration port of Hamburg, is unusual for Upper Hesse. The authorities do not like it when family fathers disappear from the scene because the community has to care for the wife and the children then. According to family tradition, it took Anna Maria a long time to make her way from northern Germany to Hesse with three small children and without money. Everything she and her husband had owned, they sold before they left. Anna Maria will be dependent on her creditors and relatives for the rest of her life. All that awaited her was the grave of her eldest son. He had died in 1835 at the age of about six and had been buried by Pastor Friedrich Ludwig Weidig. Shortly thereafter, Weidig is arrested in the Obergleen Rectory and jailed in Darmstadt prison. His wife Amelie hopes in vain for his release. Anna Maria Felsing will also never see her husband again. He's gone, lost in America, as if he had never existed. Later research in archives and databases comes to nothing.
Our Conrad lies over the ocean. Our Conrad lies over the sea. Our Conrad lies over the ocean. Oh, bring back our Conrad to me. Bring back, oh, bring back our Conrad to me. Bring back, oh, bring back our Conrad to me. his wife Anna, and his dear children. Oh, they stood alone at the pier. Didn't they have money for tickets? Or why they are still here? Bring back, oh, bring back my Conrad to me. Bring back, oh, bring back my Conrad to me. From farm to farm did she go back, worked for bed and also for bread. And has she started with nothing, and believed her husband was dead? Bring back, oh, bring back my Conrad to me. Bring back, oh, bring back my Conrad to me. Nobody has found out what happened, only that he had reached the port. Without any trace, Conrad vanished, and Anna, she prayed to the Lord. Bring back, oh, bring back my Conrad to me. Bring back, oh, bring back my Conrad to me. He never wrote her a letter. Our carpenter, he couldn't write. Anna's life never got better. No widow, no one at her side. Bring back, oh, bring back my Conrad to me. Bring back, oh, bring back my Conrad to me. One day she gave birth to a daughter, no father officially known. Her eldest son died when he was sick. This is what the church books have shown. Conrad, why did you leave them all alone, alone? Conrad, why didn't you ever come home?
Where to go in America? In 1848, Georg Troy recommended settling in one of the western states, although not on the west coast, in Ohio, Indiana, Missouri, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Illinois, or Wisconsin, states which, in his estimation, have a climate very similar to that in Germany, and in which the prices of land are not yet too high. He gives tips on currency exchange, insurance, citizenship, and buying land, and warns against thieves and fraudsters. So, he advises every newcomer
that he should be careful when leaving the ship, that he should carry his cash with him whenever possible, and that he should not let anyone know that he had anything. He should not trust anyone who approaches him to give him good advice, even if this person speaks German and makes him the most beautiful promises in the terms of employment, land purchase, travel opportunity, housing, and the like.
Germans should also be wary of Americans in general, Georg Troy warns his compatriots.
As a rule, the American is clever, very skillful in life and business, sharp-sighted, active, inquisitive, and extremely addicted to money and profit. For the German, and especially for the new immigrant, extreme caution is therefore necessary if he does not want to see himself deceived and betrayed at every step. He cannot be suspicious enough in this regard. In addition, the American is a proud and considers his nation the first in the world. The Germans are not held in high esteem by him, and they are usually given the derisive name Dutchman.
Who were those ancestors, and where did they go? Not many genealogists are as active as Linda Silverman Scheffler, a descendant of Brunel Lahm from Oberglin. Her family had been living in this little village in Upper Hesse for at least 200 years, from 18th century until the Nazi time. Linda Silverman Scheffler shares the results of several decades of research, several 10,000s of names, and a lot of life stories on MyHeritage.
I'm the second great-granddaughter of Bertha Lamb, who was born in Oberglin in 1832. I knew a lot about Bertha's husband, Aaron Marx, who was from Sterbfritz, and even grew up with a picture of him, which was taken when he served in the Union Army during the American Civil War. Bertha remained a mystery. 30 years ago, when I started my family research, the wife of a second cousin of my grandmother told me the only thing she knew about Grandma Bertha was that Bertha had family in Baltimore, Maryland. It took me 20 years before I was finally able to figure out who Bertha's family was and where she was originally from. From my research, I've been able to figure out some of the details of her life. Bertha was born Brunel Lamb in February 1832. She was the daughter of Jacob Eliezer Lozman, who took the surname Lamb in January 1809, and his wife Sus Huxter from Storndorf. She was the fifth of eight children. There were four boys and four girls. It was quite common in the 1800s for Jewish girls to leave their families and immigrate to America. The primary reason was that their parents couldn't afford the dowry, the auster, for more than one or two daughters, and in America, a dowry wasn't necessary. Many times, girls would travel in groups of cousins or groups from the same village, and they would settle in cities where there were a large community of German Jews. I've never found the ship manifest for Bertha, but I suspect she came to America with cousins from her mother's Huxter family, as many of them also immigrated in the 1850s. Bertha was the only one of her siblings to immigrate. As a matter of fact, no one else from her family that I could find came to America until the children of her brother settled in Baltimore in the 1880s.
Baltimore was one of the favorite destinations for Upper Hessians in the United States, but where did Bertha go?
Bertha settled initially in Cincinnati, Ohio, where she met and married my second great-grandfather, Aaron Marks, in 1856. After Cincinnati, they spent some years in a town outside of Cleveland, where Aaron worked as a bookbinder. Sometime in 1861, they moved to Erie, Pennsylvania, where Aaron joined the Union Army. They stayed there until 1869, when they moved to Cleveland. By then, Bertha was the mother of six sons and one daughter, born in four different cities. I believe they moved to Cleveland as Bertha had a lot of relatives there from the Huxter family. Aaron went on to become the first Jewish policeman of Cleveland in 1870, and he remained on the police force until his retirement in January 1897 at the age of 63. Sadly, Bertha died shortly after Aaron retired in August of 1897 at the age of 65.
Amazingly, for the 19th century, all of Bertha's seven children survived childhood and lived long lives. Today, there are six generations of descendants of Bertha and Aaron. But not every Hessian migrant has founded a family in America. During the time of the gold rush, young girls and women from Hesse go to the Wild West as hurdy-gurdy girls, sell dances for a dollar, and prostitute themselves. In 1864, four 15 to 17-year-olds from the Butchbach area follow a man who wanted to bring them to California as barrel organ players. He has promised them 1,000 guilders a year, 20 times as much as a maid or a seamstress earns annually. When the girls are picked up in Dusseldorf, they don't even have papers with them. Jewish women from Galicia are among the preferred victims of the matchmakers. In 1902, Rabbi Leopold Rosenach from Bremen publicly warns against such traffickers for girls, and the League of Nations tries to fight white slavery. Brothels were waiting for many young women, if not factories or fields. A Klezma song from early 20th century tells a sad story of a beautiful cheerful Jewish immigrant whose American dream hasn't come true, the Green Cousin.
Freedom is a precious commodity in America, not for the natives, the Asian railroad workers, or the black slaves, but for most of the whites, especially for the men among them. Georg Troy comments,
"What has my greatest applause of the vaunted American freedom," says Vulpius, "is that the individual in the United States, according to his inner urge and circumstances, can move freely on the outside. He can come and go when and where he wants. If he doesn't like it in one place, he packs up and wanders someplace else without being attacked by the gendarmes and policemen and asked for his passport, nor inhibited by guild institutions or similar stories. Incidentally, this freedom also has its dark side, among other things, that everywhere, depending on the size of the place, one finds a lot of unemployed people who cannot find work, or day thieves and loafers who do not want to find one, who now stay in the boarding houses and taverns and make their living with card games and all sorts of finger arts."
And unlike in Germany, there is freedom of trade. Only lawyers need an exam, neither doctors, nor teachers, nor clergy. If you want, you can try your hand at all kinds of professions, even several at the same time. Congregations can hire and dismiss their pastors and teachers themselves, and it is not only the question of dowry or trousseau that plays a lesser role in the surplus of men in the United States, which is why immigrant women often find a man quite quickly, not infrequently one with a similar origin. And the best news for all of those who are as poor as church mice and not allowed to decide for themselves? In America, couples do not need the approval of a local council to get married.
If a couple wants to get married, all it takes is that they go to a pastor or justice of the peace and make their declaration. From the latter, it then receives a confirmation slip, which costs $2, 5 guilders. That's the end of it.
In his travel guide, Georg Troy also explains the form of government, and thus democracy. This is uncharted territory for Germans, who will not live in a republic until after the First World War.
North America has no emperors, kings, princes, but every 4 years, the people elect a man from among themselves, to whom the highest dignity of the country is confirmed. The man's title is president. When the time of his administration is over, he descends again from his height and becomes, as before, a simple citizen. The president can be elected for a second time, but not for a third time. He receives an annual salary of $25,000 or 60,000 guilders because of his office, certainly a very significant sum compared to the European conditions. Each individual state is independent, has its own representation of the people, orders its internal administration independently of the federal government, and enacts its own laws.
For example, on the abolition of slavery in Missouri, with active Hessian participation, as we will hear in the next part, some suffered from homesickness forever, and others, like Friedrich Münch from Niedergemünden, Herbert Sondheim from Oberglein, Ruth Stern Gaston from Niederohmen, or Ruth Stern Glass Ernest from Dietz, returned to their birthplace once, but didn't feel at home anymore. the following cover song of Waltzing Matilda, with lyrics written by Monica Felsing from Oberglein, is about that feeling of alienation. Go away, come back, even you won't stay here, the refrain says. What binds you to a place are the people, also those who aren't alive anymore. Nature is vulnerable, houses can be destroyed, and it would be a lie to say it doesn't matter. Your soul sings a song of past times. You know that clocks stand still if they are not wound up or out of order, but time never sleeps. Go away, come back. Something of you will stay here. The first part of our podcast ends with this song. It had been recorded spontaneously in 2018, together with the audience in the former synagogue of Oberglein in Upper Hessian dialect. I've been listening to the podcast, Now We Go Overseas, a free production from the Historical Society L'Storia, Bremen, with volunteers from the United States. This was part one, Out of Necessity to America, Hessian Refugees in the 19th and Early 20th Century, written by and final technical editing by Monica Felsing. English version directed by Susan Eldridge. Copyright in Connecticut, United States, and Bremen, Germany, 2023 and 2024. The Historical Society L'Storia wishes to thank every volunteer who participated in this transatlantic project about migration, as well as everyone who has performed the research and published the information from which this was written. Our podcast consists of six parts. The original version is in German. The German historian Monica Felsing used AI for initial translations of her manuscript from German to English, which was then revised with help from Susan Eldridge, née Bodenhausen. The English and German parts of the podcast are online in the United States at badmorgen.wordpress.com. That's badmorgen.wordpress.com. In Germany, you can find them at monikafelsing.de. That's monikafelsing.de. We would like to thank all the volunteer readers in their order of appearance. The first narrator was read by Susan Eldridge in America. Our first heard singer, Nikki Rittenhouse, sang our cover song, Now We Go Overseas, as well as Our Conrad Lies Over the Ocean. The second narrator was read by Thomas Fulton in America, who also read the Hessian Soldier's Poem and the beginning of the Bremen Town Musician story. Friedrich Jakob Wickelhausen was read by Thorolf Dunkel in Germany, who also read the Asfeld newspaper segments. Monika Felsing in Germany read Katharina Lanz Büttner's letters to her father and also three poems, the first about the female emigrant, the second about Germans remaining in their homeland, and the third about the Germans preparing to leave. Douglas Eldridge in America read segments by Walter Rupenthal, Jörn Jakob Sveen, Georg Fett, as well as Heinrich Lemke's Golden Rules for Emigrants. The German Society of the City of New York segments were read by Regina Diesold in Germany. Carolyn Schott in America researched her German roots originating in Oberglin and spoke about her five times great-grandfather, Michael Schott, who was born there. Georg Trau was read by Joseph Garms in America. Linda Silverman Scheffler performed the research and spoke about her findings regarding her German roots, including her second great-grandmother, Bertha Lum, who was born in Oberglin. Die Grüne Cousin, the Green Cousin, was performed by Burkhard Bach in Germany. The final song, Go Away, Come Back, was performed by Monika Felsing and her audience in Oberglin in 2018. The manuscripts and bibliography will be available at a later date. If you would like to listen to them, please don't hesitate to contact us in Germany at mail@lastoria-bremen.de or in the United States at badmoregenealogy@gmail.com. Our next podcast will be Part 2, Departure to Freedom, of 500 who set out to find and fight for human rights. Some of them have changed the country they settled in for the better. Copyright, all rights reserved, public performance only with the permission from the Historical Society Lastoria, Bremen. Bremen, Germany, and Connecticut, USA, 2023 and 2024.